All right, and we are joined here with Lisa Byrne, and talk a little bit about some of her running history. And Lisa is a medical professional, also a runner, ultra trail runner, has a lot of history in that in the sport, and really curious to hear some of her experience as a medical personnel in the field in working at races. So, Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike, you want to fire off? What do you guess for some?
Well, I guess maybe let's just start off like, who are you? What are you all about? Yeah. I mean, Tony and I know you, but you know, for our readers, you know, what races have you been doing this year?
Okay. Yeah. About myself, I started running a little bit back in college, but not very seriously, and then kind of picked it up after I had young kids as a way to get out of the house. And a little bit of time and exercise, and didn't get really serious about it until, gosh, the early 2000s, which I realize that's 20 years ago now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like it'd be like 10 years ago, maybe, or something.
I know.
Let me say 2000s.
Yeah. And I think about how old my kids are now, because they're both adults, and think, yeah. Oh yeah, they were like babies, and I pushed them in a burly stroller to get out for my runs. Mm-hmm. So I started out my career as an environmental educator, and then I went back to school and became an RN. And because I hang around races a lot, I got really interested in race medicine and, you know, wilderness medicine as it applies to ultra endurance sports.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Where'd you go to school then?
Well, I've gone.
I mean, I guess in college when you started running.
Yeah, so I was I was at Northland College in Ashland, Wisconsin, and one of my friends was a cross country runner, and he talked me into running with him. And actually talked me into doing a 10K, which was, I finished it, but they thought I was lost on the course. It took me so long. Because he's like, if you've run 3 miles, you can run 6 miles. That's a lie. Yeah. And it was down in on the Hayward Trails down in Cable. Yeah. So I have I have vivid memories of that. And then just kind of played around with running, not very much for many, many years. And then we moved to Duluth. I was at UMD I graduated from UMD with my first degree, ran with the kids. And then when I went back to nursing school, I went to the College of St. Scholastica. So I've got two degrees.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Are you originally from Duluth or?
Bloomington, Minnesota. Bloomington. Yeah. So, okay. Yeah, I grew up in Bloomington playing out in the woods. Back then it was much more rural. Like I used to walk past a farm to go to my elementary school.
Uh-huh.
And just playing out in the woods and stuff. So I've always been out in the woods.
Yeah.
So back when Highland was surrounded by woods. And now it's surrounded by homes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So your entry to running has been kind of slow and just a little bit of dabbling. What kind of got you into it to the point where you're like, I'm a runner. This is what I want to do.
You know, I think I started showing up for the NMTC spring series. Mm-hmm. And back then, it was a very small group of people. 20, 30, maybe 40 tops. And Jean Kernow and Barb Kernow, Kathy Wicks, Ed Dahlman, that whole group just welcomed me in. Sarah Hollingsworth, a lot of those folks. And so it was a small enough group that you could easily say, oh, you're a newcomer. Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, and introduce yourself. And so they just welcomed me in and started, you know, I'd show up for those and it'd be like me and four other women.
Wow.
And back then, they published the results in the newspaper, and they published the top five people, and I'm like, I made it into the paper. And people go, well, how many women were there? Five, but so what? I was number five at your point.
I'm in the newspaper.
I'm in there, you know. So, you know, and it was just that encouragement. And then I started running.
Was that in like the early 2000s?
Yeah, that would have been the early 2000s. Those are the lost years of the NMTC results, I feel like, because I don't think they all made it onto Northland Runner.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like I think some did and some didn't. And so I know it was, you know, 2004, 2005, 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually have some of my running logs from back then, because Runner's World would send you a log every time you subscribe.
Yeah, exactly. I have a whole bunch of those.
Yeah. And so I can go back and look at those and kind of piece out a little bit of my running history.
Mm-hmm. Was Jaro on like a hiatus or something? Or where were the results?
I don't. They're probably in a file box somewhere.
Oh, they're,
you know,
just,
I'm
never
sure
got
the Kernows kept them. And you know, they're probably sitting in a file box either at Chris's house or Jaro's house.
Yeah.
So Jaro, get on it.
That's interesting that, you know, you say that that's kind of how, what really kind of turned the page from really recreational to being more of a serious runner.
Yeah.
And now you're on the board of directors for...
Not any longer for NMTC. Yeah, okay. I was. Excuse me. Yeah, no. Right. I went off the board last January. My term was up, and just with things that were going on personally, I decided I needed... I just need to take a break and concentrate a little bit on my own stuff. But I'm still... I'm the race medic for them, and so I'm... And I still kind of talk about we as if I'm on the board because I was so involved with the group for so long.
And it's all a group of friends anyway, so you see them all the time. Yeah, the same
and
people.
We end up talking about race stuff.
Right.
And I still go out and help with coursework and help with flagging.
Right,
right.
You know,
I kind of feel like it's the same, even though that there's like almost 200 people at these NMTC races these days. It's still kind of this welcoming environment.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's, you know, separates into groups. You know, as it would be with hundreds of people, but almost like, you know, front of the pack, middle pack, end of pack. And people can't, you kind of welcome in like, oh, okay, this guy's fast. Like, come on, you know.
But, you know, they mix too. The thing I like about trail running, and, you know, I think it was discovering trail running that turned me from being like a part-time, you know, runner. I'm going to go do a 5K, maybe a half marathon, to like really liking running was getting on the trails. But then our groups mix. So it's not like, oh, I can't talk to Mike. He's fast. You know?
Right.
I'm kind of a middle to the back of the pack, or depending on the day, or you know, and you know, I hang out with people. You know, it just depends.
Yeah.
You
know? Mm-hmm.
It just depends.
Exactly. Yeah, I think the one thing with the NMTC race is that I agree with that with what you said. Like, everybody gets along, and no matter where you are finish wise on the race. And that's something that's kind of unique sometimes in the running world, and specifically more so in the road running world, but the trail world does tend to, everybody embraces everybody kind of a thing. And NMTC has, to me, as far as I know, has had that culture since day one.
Yeah.
You know, since the early days when there's maybe seven people at the NMTC races in the early 80s.
Yeah.
It's cool that that's continued for so long.
Besides like sheer numbers, have you seen, I mean, you've been at these series races now for almost 20 years, right? I mean, have you seen any big changes throughout your time being pretty, you know, intimately involved with NMTC?
More women are coming, which is great. Because like I said, in the early days, it would be, you know, like 20, 30 people, four or five women.
Yeah.
Tops, you know. And so it's fun to see more women running, more women feeling comfortable running. Just the growth of it, for one thing, is kind of astounding. And I know I know some folks don't come because it's just too many folks.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just
on
feels
a tight trail.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's understandable. Yeah. It can be a little crowded sometimes. Some of the races get a little bottlenecked.
Yeah.
So I get that. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, some of them, just like the Rock Hill, because it's right at UMD.
Exactly.
You get a lot of the college students.
Yeah.
You know, and Hartley draws a lot of people, which is fun. It's fun, you know, and it's getting people who have maybe never trail run out there. I think the cool thing is you get, you know, I learned a lot about different trails in Duluth just from showing up at the races.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
there used to be so lost if I didn't, if there wasn't for the, I get lost with the flagging. Actually,
sometimes.
Because I'm running, looking down when I'm running.
Yeah. But, pay attention to the flagging. Although I haven't flagged an NMTC course in a few years.
Yeah.
So just because my work schedule just doesn't allow it. So.
Yeah.
I've been doing the NMTC races, you know, maybe for seven, eight years or something like that. And I think one of the biggest changes that I've seen is the kind of the attention to the trail conditions. Whereas I remember right away that it was kind of a non-factor, and we'd run through some really swampy, muddy runs where you'd be covered. And granted, there were a few runs even this year where I ended up being just covered in mud by the end, but that's a big consideration.
The trail ethic and trail etiquette has changed a lot over the years. And a lot of what, you know, NMTC runs or had run on was not trail. I mean, it precedes the SHT. It precedes. And so, but that attention to, hey, and part of it's the numbers, you know. You got 20 people out there, you're not doing the same kind of impact on the trails that 150 people do. And so it's, we need to pay attention. We need to be more aware. Plus, our climate has changed drastically in 20 years, and it is wetter now.
Yeah.
And so it used to be the spring races were kind of the ones where you'd expect to get pretty wet and muddy, and now it's like,
now it's
it doesn't matter. It's
almost
year-round.
All of them. Yeah. Yeah, that Piedmont run, you always had that little swampy lake
the,
that you would have to run through.
Run.
The goat run.
Yeah. That one's...
That one was...
That one got shut down.
It was a lot of fun, but the city didn't like that at all.
And the the interesting thing is that swampy lake we ran through was all ATV damage. That wasn't because I lived in that neighborhood and it wasn't there when we first moved in. It was because of ATVers using it and degrading the area. And then, you know, and we were sticking to the trails.
Right.
They had done a lot of damage up there.
Yeah, the ATVs do. And the horses at times too on any trails where there's a lot of horse use, horses can really chew up trail and cause quite a channel. You know, they start just going single file and you start to really chew up a channel sometimes.
Which is why Magny Snively had all that money infused to improve the trail there because it's where you can ride.
Yep.
And so they had to harden the trail off for the horses. They're, you know, 1,000 pounds.
Yeah.
On the little hoof.
On the little hoof, that's going to go right in. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's fun to run in the mud? I mean, I kind of do, and like the novelty of it sometimes, of like you're just going out in the spring for this raunchy, muddy trail run.
Yeah.
But then you're like, you know, obviously it's not great for the trail. Where's the fine line?
Well, you know? Except as long as you're staying in the trail and on the treadway, you're really, you're minimizing the impact of that one like 18-inch corridor. It's the folks, and I see this all the time, who, why don't I get my feet wet? And they go around, and then the people behind them go around. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I saw this, I was flagging for Wild Duluth, and there was a runner, you know, with a event shirt on who was picking their way around the puddle. And I bit my tongue. I was like, this is not the place or the time.
Yeah.
But it's like, just walk through.
Right.
Because now you're creating more damage, and you're widening the trail. And that's... and. Lots of hikers, lots of dog walkers. It's not just exclusively runners. Bikers do the same thing, even though they're told to go through. They go around. And you can see, like at Hartley, you can see what that's done to the trails there.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it used to be single track. It's not so single track anymore.
It's almost like a PSA. Like, again, you know, kind of 7-8 years ago, that wasn't even a thing. Like are you supposed to? No, you're supposed to go around.
Yeah.
No. And then it's kind of come out as like, you know, go straight through, get muddy.
Although that's been, like, because my first degree is in environmental education.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I've known about Leave No Trace for, when did I get my first degree? 28-ish years ago.
You're right.
Yeah, and even back then it was go stay in the middle of the trail. It's just...
makes sense.
There's so many more people out using the trail, and we've, as a community... of runners, bikers, the city of Duluth have lagged behind the education side of that, of here's good trail ethics.
Yeah, that's what I'd love to see a little. It's just, it's really, really simple for me to just kind of say, here's what needs to happen, because there's a million things that go into all that, but some sort of public education that the city needs to back somehow. And I understand they don't have the funding and the personnel and all that for it. So I don't mean to be overly critical, just somehow the public needs to know this stuff. Because a lot of it is they just don't know.
I've been trying to work on that for years now and kind of poking different groups and saying, you know, I'm interested in doing this. What I need is a graphic artist because I'm not an artist. I can't, except with knitting needles, I can't come up with the logos and stuff. But there's some really good examples out there nationwide. And there's actually a group that kind of COGS pulled together of runners, hikers, cyclists to work on trail safety and etiquette. And so we're just getting going on that. But I've been trying to kind of get this going for a while and go, you know, I've got we don't have to recreate the wheel here.
Yeah.
The information's out there. We just need to.
I've seen programs like that in other communities on television, on public access and things where they have like DNR officers who kind of, it's like a half hour program and they sit down and they just go over trail etiquette and why you're supposed to do this. And here's how, what you're supposed to do in this situation, whether it's paved or dirt trails. And that was, you know, that was in another community that I lived in. It was great. I learned a ton.
Yeah.
And then it's because it's public access is cheap and it's on 24 hours. You know, you can just kind of
just have to have cable.
See it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was just one avenue, and this is kind of pre-internet days. And now you've got the internet and you've got plenty of options that way. Like for instance, recently we saw the Poop Fairy.
Yes.
That was a great campaign.
That is beautiful.
That's wonderful. That, to me, was probably relatively inexpensive to produce and pretty quick. More things like that would be great.
Yeah. So hopefully that's coming.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. How did you get into longer races? How many 100 milers have you finished now?
I have finished 2. I have started 4.
Uh-huh.
So all up at Superior, that was my first 100.
Yeah.
And I kind of joke about this, but you know how your parents say, you know, choose your friends wisely. Mm-hmm. Well, I started hanging out with ultra runners. Yeah, yeah. And initially I was like, 30-mile run? That's insane. Who would do that?
Should have listened to mom and dad.
Yeah. And then you just kind of gradually, it becomes the norm. And I, you know, like Eugene Kernow, Ed Dahlman, Kathy Wicks, were all part of the NMTC running community when I first kind of fell into it. And they just really mentored me. And like Ed, I have to give a shout out to him because the first year I ever ran Kernow, which was my first and only marathon, has been the Kernow. Uh-huh. It was a Jarrows Beach year. And he took me out on training runs and he's like teaching me the course.
Yeah.
And, you know, like drew me a map and was like giving me expected times. Wow. And he really like just took me under his wing. And,
you know,
I go out for runs with those guys and, you know, listen to their stories. And, you know, and then it's like, well, I've done a marathon. And Kernow on a Jarrows Beach year is...
It's
no joke.
It's basically an ultra.
Yeah, yeah. As Jarrell says, it's a marathon that runs like an ultra.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the next step, well, it's not that much more difficult to jump up to a 50K.
Right.
And Andy Holak and I had worked together scouting routes for the Spear Hiking Trail to go through Duluth. And we'd sit there and talk about how great it would be to have a trail race on the Spear Hiking Trail, you know, a trail race in Duluth. And and then so when he started off Wild Duluth, I was actually there the beta year when he had like four people show up and just run the course. That was in 2008 and just see like what's the fastest possible time, what's the slowest, is this even doable?
Yeah.
And so when that started, that was my first 50K.
Yeah,
That was 2009. So I started doing ultras in 2009, and between 2009 and 2010, I think I did six.
Wow!
In that year span,
jumped right in.
I jumped right in. You know, I actually did like Wild Duluth 50K. Went down and did Surf the Mirth 50K 2 weeks later, and then you know took the winter off, and then did I don't even remember what I did.
Yeah,
you know, so I just kind of went crazy with it and had a really you know. So 2010 was a really good year. I think I did, no, 2012 was my first Voyager. So I volunteered at Voyager for many, many years at the J. Cook aid station for many, many, many years. And then I started running and then your volunteering gets a little harder to do if you want to run a race.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. Did you always have this like I want to do a 100-miler, I want to do a 50-miler? It's just like, well, I did the marathon, next up.
50K, yeah, yeah. Next up. Then it just started snowballing. You know, I remember after Wild Duluth, Leslie and I were like, we should run. You know, if you run Voyager, I'll run Voyager. You know, and we're very different time spans, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we both goaded each other on and do it, and then it just, you know, and then I think. I paced Rick Bothwell at Superior in 2000. It was the rainy year.
10?
Yeah, it might have been 2010 or 11. 10.
I think it was 10.
Yeah.
Because I ran it in 2011. And I think the year before, Ron Hendrickson ran it.
Yes.
That, yeah. I think it was 2010.
That was just crazy rainy and cold. Yeah. But I learned from him that like, you can eat. Like, he would eat a hamburger at an aid station and then take off, you know. And that kind of all of a sudden I was like, oh, I could do 100K then. Mm-hmm. And I jumped in, and I did Wild Duluth 100K, I want to say in 2011. Maybe it was 2010, I don't remember. And I'd always said I would never do that one. It's too hard.
Yeah.
It's crazy hard.
Yeah.
Then I did it. You know, and then from there,
I mean, it's the local race.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then from there, I just kind of fell into. So 2012 was the first year I ran Superior. And that was back because I dropped at Voyager that year.
Mm-hmm.
No, so I did run Voyager in 2010. Yeah, so I dropped at Voyager that year. That was the flood year.
Oh, sure. 2012.
And the course was
totally different.
Totally different. And I had helped clear the course. I had helped figure out a course. And by the time it came to race day, I hated that course.
Yeah.
And I just was like, I did one loop and I'm like, I don't want to go back out there.
Mm-hmm. It was a loop course.
It was a loop course, starting and ending at the zoo.
Oh.
And we bopped out to the power lines, but we didn't go any further than that.
Okay.
And, yeah, it was not my favorite course at all.
Yeah.
But then I had thought about doing Superior. And then I was like, well, if I if Voyager doesn't go well, I'm not going to do Superior. And I dropped at Voyager, and then 2 weeks later, I signed up for Superior.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because it was like, you know, that was just that. Yeah. And but you could do that. You could sign up in August.
Right. Crazy. You know?
Yep.
So it's not like that anymore.
Right. Yeah.
Do you have a race distance, you know, whether it be road, trail, whatever, that you think you're best at? And what's your favorite race distance?
I don't know that I suck at the half marathon. That is based on all my attempts at the Gary Bjorklund and the Whistle Stop, where no matter how well trained I am, I still run a 158. And I'm like, I'm faster than that, but I suck at it. I don't know. I seem to do better the longer the distance, you know, like I did. My Superior times have been pretty decent, I think, for me, you know, I
mean, yeah.
I dropped last year when I finished, I took 35 or so minutes off my 2012 time.
Yeah.
And that's being significantly older.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not young, so it's not easy to do. I kind of like the 50. The 50K is fun because I feel like you don't have to be super, you don't have to dedicate your whole life to it.
Right.
And you can bang out a 50K.
Yeah.
50 miles takes a little more training, you know, but you're still done in a day.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
for me, I'll never finish 100 mile under 24 hours. So it's knowing I'm going to go without sleep and.
Yep. Yeah. Any desire for the 200 mile distance?
Absolutely that's starting to not.
Become a thing? No.
No.
No. Yeah. That's an entirely different beast. And 100 miler is different than a 50 miler.
Yeah.
But then the 200 miler.
No, no, it's just like your first 10K. Like, you run 100, you can run 200.
Maybe I could. I just, the time it takes and the dedication and the money.
Yeah.
That's.
Yeah, I know. They're expensive.
Like, over, I think, $1,000.
Yeah.
I'm just like,
Travel, plus food.
Plus travel, plus, you know, if you're going to bring crew out with you.
Yeah. Can you do it without a crew? Like, I mean, logistically?
You probably can, but you better have things dialed in.
Yeah. And then you're going to need a handful of days off of work after
so I mean, as it is, like, to do 100, I take the day before the 100 starts, and I take 2 days off after because I don't have a really physical job, but I'm on my feet all day. And what I do, part of it is, it's not so much my feet are swollen and I'm sore, it's mentally I'm not all there. And what I do for a living, I need to be mentally present and all there and sharp. And so I don't, like, you know. So other people can do that.
I'm curious to see if those 200 milers, they're starting to grow a little bit, but I don't see it exploding the way the 100 miler thing kind of exploded in the last 10 years and even almost like 5 years, really.
Yeah.
It feels like. I just don't see the 200 becoming that the next thing as much.
Yeah. I think it just takes, I mean, it's kind of like doing a winter, going up and doing the ITI. It just takes so much.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like trail runners at the top of the funnel and then like 50 mile runners, less people for the 100 mile, and then way less, you know, that's like the bottom of the tip of the
I mean, just look at like Arrowhead and Tuscobia.
Yeah.
You take all these trail runners and how many of them are doing winter ultras?
Yeah, right.
You know.
Exactly. And with those two races specifically, the numbers have increased simply because of fat bikes.
Yes.
The fat bike has made it so much more doable for so many more people. That's kind of.
So I remember the early years and people were on just regular mountain
bikes.
Just
a normal 26-inch mountain bike.
No.
Yeah. Before fat bikes were a thing.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Yeah. But now that that dominates the whole overall field in terms of numbers participating.
And I go down to Tuscobia every year. I missed one because I was having car issues, and that is not the time of year you want to find out your car's not.
Oh, man, no doubt.
Yeah. But yeah, I've either gone and spectated or now for the past, I don't even know how many years, I volunteer there.
Yeah.
So that's kind of I actually put that down like at work as I'm gone.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, you're going down for that.
I'm going down for that.
Yeah. I remember you at that aid station that one
year. Yeah. And now I'm at the start finish. I'm there and I kind of hold down the fort there. Because I have issues being out in the cold for very long. So they don't put me at the places where I'll get cold. Helen and Chris take really good care of me.
Yeah, nice. So.
Should we talk about kind of your race medic?
Let's hear. We need to hear some of those stories. Kind of, some of your experiences out in the field, if as a as a medical personnel.
So I don't even know how I fell into being identified as a race medic.
Started,
So I've, because I volunteered at races for a bunch, and I think, and maybe with John Storkamp down at Zumbro, but you know, he's got a pretty slick system for his volunteers, and I was just like, well, you know, I'm an RN, and I have, you know, a medical background, and so I kind of got paired up with Joy Parker, and the two of us, you know, were just kind of, 1 year we're stationed at the start finish, and we just kind of dealt with whatever came in, and then, you know, Joy would go out to an aid station if need be.
Like on call, kind of?
Yeah, like on call. Okay. So that's, and, you know, which is similar to what I do now for Kurnow and Voyager, is I'm kind of roaming the course.
Right.
Or I'll go plunk myself down. And I do the same thing for a while, Duluth, the last couple of years since I haven't run it, is, you know, if I'm not running, I'll be race medic. And I'll just be available. And I usually go check in at the aid stations, let the aid station volunteers kind of like, here's what to look for. If you have any concerns, call me. If it's a true emergency, use our ham radio folks to activate 911. And the reason for that, it's not that people can't pick up their cell phone and call 911. Well, some places they can't. Grand Portage, there's no cell coverage.
Right.
But the ham folks know exactly where we are and how to get the EMS folks to the right place as quickly as possible. So that they're a great... And actually, it's, those guys have gotten me to be... I'm ham licensed, so now I've got my radio. And, and that comes in handy, because then when I go to Zumbro, I've got my radio. And if I have to go out after someone, I can communicate what's going on. And so through that, I started doing more... I renewed my wilderness medicine, my wilderness first aid certificate. And then there's also some really good information out there from Marty Hoffman with the Western States Endurance Race. He does a bunch of, they've got a whole group that does research on the runners. And so they've come up with a whole bunch of information that's specific to ultra races.
Oh, interesting.
Because that's different.
So
like if you were, you know, to go into an ER after running 100 miles, your labs are going to look wonky. And that doctor, if they don't know anything about ultra runs, is probably going to be like, oh my gosh. Not be anything to get that worked up about. But like if you
given
just,
the circumstances.
Given the circumstances.
Yeah, but compared to a normal person.
So I'm always like, I never get lab work after 100. You don't want to know. Best to not know what's going on. So I've been corresponding with them. They've got an ultra medicine group kind of going and are trying to provide more education to folks who volunteer at ultra races about what to look for. And so
what do you see most often in your experience? Like what's the biggest issue?
Nausea is a big one. The stomach going sour, blisters, chafing. You know, there was a guy at Wild Duluth this year that just had bloody nipples early on. And I kept thinking, how? Wow. Like, I thought guys had that figured out.
Nope.
Yeah.
Pro trip, bras.
There you go. Yeah.
If you forget the Band-Aids.
Yeah.
Women don't have that issue.
Right.
Yeah. And they hold ice, so they're great. So hot races. Like, Black Hills this year was ridiculously hot.
Yeah.
And it's like... Bra in the bandana, bra in the hat, bra, or not bra, ice everywhere. It was like ice, you know?
Yeah.
Men's sport bras, is that like a void in the market?
Yeah.
Right.
Huh. Like the bro, you know, side
cut. Bro.
Exactly.
Nausea is an interesting one, especially, you know, stomach, nausea. I don't know how familiar you are with like food stuff, but like what's a way to avoid that? I guess coming into the race, during the race. You know, do you have how do you treat that normally?
So individual. The first thing I'll do with folks is ask them what they've been eating and drinking. Because sometimes it's just a matter of having, like, are your electrolytes out of balance? Right. So if they say, I've been just drinking water, it's like, okay, let's stop drinking the water. Let's start doing some electrolyte, you know, like whatever the race has. You know, do sips of that. So it's usually sips and little bites of stuff. Can you hold that down? For some people, vomiting just resets. It's like, boop, reset button, and now they're okay. I've never been a vomiter. And so the first time I vomited in a race, I was like, oh, I guess I'm going to keep going. I dropped out of Superior 1 year because I was nauseous for like 35 miles and wasn't eating because I stopped eating, which you cannot do. You just have to keep putting food in. You know, and you got to try and find what works. And for some people, like for me, I can't do a lot of sweet stuff that just turns my stomach. And for anybody who knows me, I'm on a really restrictive, somewhat restrictive diet. And that's made a big difference for me because it turned out that a lot of the stuff that was normal race food was actually causing me GI distress.
Some issues, So.
Normal race food, air quotes, is junk food.
Well, really, junk food, but even like the electrolyte mix, the sugars in those all cause me issues. And so, you know, I now use, actually it's kind of funny. I use maple syrup. And I use Untappd products. I use their maple syrup packets, even though I have a gallon of maple syrup in my fridge. And I use their electrolyte mix, which is based off of maple sugar. And I don't have issues. But I went through, I cycled through a bunch of different stuff trying to find what I could tolerate. And so I think my biggest advice to people is practice. Is on those training runs, you got to figure out what works for you. And then, you know, keep putting food in. You know,
do you think you can train yourself to like get better at running with food? I think of this sometimes. I'm like, I should just eat like a triple cheeseburger and then do speed work. Okay, maybe not. Maybe not, but,
speed work.
But you know, like kind of push the boundary of like, this should upset my stomach. But if I like kind of pushing the envelope, then I'll harden my stomach. I don't know if there's any truth in that.
I don't know. I mean, I kind of do that. Like this summer when I was training, I would eat like my breakfast, which is a big smoothie, and go out and do my 3-hour long run, you know, on a full stomach. And there is some, you know, like, then you can do that and you buy yourself about an hour. You know, plus you're training your stomach to run with food in it, which
jostle around.
If you're doing anything over a marathon, you've got to
be having calories.
And then I found for me personally, like, after about 35 miles or so, I crave protein. Even though it's not really doing much energy-wise, it just the salt, the like I bring jerky along and I just chew on that.
There's something to be said for that feeling of being satiated, too, just mentally. It's helpful.
But I think the biggest thing, I mean, for that is just you've got to kind of figure it out. And then don't give up. You know, just because, okay, I'm nauseous and I'm moving slower. It's like, okay, but you still got time, which my crew in 2017 wouldn't let me drop till I timed out.
I suppose as a race medic, you have a lot of kind of like bedside manner, to, so to speak, like where you probably relied on, you know, from these people to say like, you're okay. You can keep going. No, I'm done. I'm throwing up. My stomach hurts. I'm done. No, you're probably okay. Just do this.
It's a lot like I always tell people. It's like, you know, like the folks who volunteer with medical background, they said 99% of what we do is parenting. You know, it's you're okay. Let's problem solve this. Let's figure out what's going on. You know, oh, you're okay. You know, and then if somebody is saying I'm going to drop, I'll always say to them, how are you going to feel about this tomorrow? Now, granted, if they have a true physical injury, sometimes I've talked to people, I'm like, you know, you really should think about dropping because live to run another day. That's kind of my motto, which I had to live out this year at Superior because I went into the race with broken ribs. I broke them just not even 3 weeks before the race. It was barely 3 weeks. I started anyway with the blessing of an orthopedic doctor who I saw the day before and was like, am I stupid to do this? And, you know, their advice was, no, you can do this, but it's going to, you're going to hurt afterwards, you know, and don't fall. And this year it was slippery out there. And I made the decision on the way into Beaver Bay. It's like my ribs are already hurting. And it's slippery, and I'd seen people fall, and then the final straw was I slipped off some boardwalk. I didn't fall, but I was like, this is just beyond stupid, because I could have perforated my lung or liver, and nothing is worth that. So, like, sometimes when people want to persist with something that's really bad, it's like, is this really worth you not being able to run again?
When you're advising a runner in those situations, whether to continue on or to drop, is it a challenge to know, like, for that individual, this is the type of person who needs a kick in the butt, or this is the type of person who needs a pat on the back?
Yeah.
Like, Because
like it's okay.
Different people respond to different things.
Yeah, and some people really need that permission or that like, listen, I'm pulling you.
Yeah.
Because then they can go back and go, yeah. I didn't drop.
Yeah, exactly.
They pulled me.
Yeah.
But you know, some people just need that. You're going to be okay. Like somebody came into Kettle. I wasn't volunteering there. I just was there crewing. And this guy came into Kettle and he was in rough shape. He gotten way behind on, way in, out of balance with his electrolytes and stuff. Had been vomiting, was not real coherent. And we got him in and I'm like, sit down. You know, he could tell us his name. He could tell us like, you know, his phone number and stuff. So we're like getting ready to call family. And I'm like, let's just do sip system. What have you been drinking? You know, just kind of talk to him. And within an hour, he was back and normal and everything fine. I'm like, you know, you have time. You could get the 100 or get the 50K, whatever, the 100K finish, whatever it was. And he was like, no, he'd already made the decision to drop. And he'd been told by other volunteers he should drop.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get, I'm like, you could walk in at 7 miles. You got this.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to get the, you know, the full distance, but you can get this.
Yeah.
And he was just done.
Yeah.
You know, and I have to admit in 2017, I was done.
Right.
They were beat me, you know, Ron was out there doing his best. Sam, everybody's doing their best to get me going. And I had mentally just checked out. I was like, I'm done. I'm tired of being nauseous and I can't move and I can't eat. And then last year I vomited and everything was okay. You know, I was nauseous all night, but then I was fine. And I PR'd. So,
wow.
Yeah, you can rally.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's sometimes it's, and it's knowing the person or having their crew. Sometimes it's pulling the crew aside and going, tell me about this person.
Yeah.
Because I don't know them.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, what about like blisters, chafing? Do you have any magic bullet that you recommend for that? Or like, what do you do right away to treat that? Maybe that's too gross to talk about.
No, I mean, it's funny because people, one is just take care of your feet off the bat. Like, know what your feet need. I'm obsessive about my feet because I have bunions. And so if I don't take care of my feet, I get really bad blisters in that area. And so I've got this thing where I like come into an aid station, I change my socks, I clean my feet, I put, you know, I use squirrel's nut butter, whatever your favorite lubrication is on them. Other people use Desitin. I take care of my feet and like don't ignore those hot spots. Unless you're in the last 20 miles of the race, and then sometimes I'll ignore them and just go.
Deal with it.
Yeah, deal with it.
Yeah.
I finished Superior 2012 with huge blisters on the bottom of my feet and every step was agony. But it didn't happen till the last 20 miles and was like, okay, I'm just going to cope.
Yeah.
You know, if it hurts to walk, it hurts to run, you might as well run.
I only have like 5 hours left. I don't have time to.
Yeah. Right. Maybe not the best decision.
Right.
You know, I think that's the big thing is just taking care of your feet. I wear gaiters all the time because I don't like stuff in my shoes.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of
gaiters. I'm like the princess and the pea. You know, I'm like, I can feel that like grain of sand, you know.
Yeah, I'm always curious why people don't wear gaiters on a long trail race. Like, why would you not?
Yeah.
Just to keep stuff out of there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some people aren't as bothered by that.
Right.
But it just
they're not. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not too bothered by it personally.
You're not. Yeah. No. Yeah, you wear your shoes really loose too. Even on trail races, do you wear them pretty loose?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Gotta.
Yeah.
Yeah. And see, I'd be slipping out of my shoes. I'm very finicky about that. So. Yeah.
You see foot blisters more so than like, you know, chafing issues or stuff like
that. Yeah. Well, people don't maybe talk about their chafing issues so much.
Right.
Like, you know, I've witnessed, you always see that guy at the aid station in 100, you know.
Legs all the way up, like bow leg.
Yeah. So. And then he's like, you know, grabbing the Vaseline, putting his hands out. I'm like, could you just step like 2 feet away from me to lubricate your bits and pieces?
Yeah.
Nobody needed to see that. But, you know, I know people have cut the linings out of their shorts. I mean, I think it's just, it's knowing your gear. Like I run in short, I don't know what they're called, short tights.
Right, right.
Yeah, because that just eliminates chafing for me, you know, so, and then.
How many times do you think you have your blisters figured out and you go on all these long runs and then it's race day and like right away, like what the heck is going on now?
Well, I think the conditions like Zumbro, that sand really.
Yeah, Zumbro's rough.
Zumbro's rough. And so like if somebody comes in with really torn up feet, it's okay, let's, you know, get their feet cleaned up, take a look at them. Can we drain them? You never actually open up a blister. You leave the skin on, but you might need to drain them if there's someplace where it's really rubbing and then taping over it. And I admittedly need to learn more about foot care stuff. I've done it professionally, but that's different. Because people are always like, oh, my feet are disgusting. I'm like, Trust me. I've seen worse. Yeah. I can guarantee you I've seen worse feet. You know, so then it's just trying to get them back and, you know, can we get this done?
Yeah.
You know, can we tape you up enough so that the tape provides something some for your sock to, yeah, to rub on instead of your skin. But hydration, I hear, is really important. If you're getting dehydrated, then your skin's not as hydrated. So
proper socks, proper fitting socks too, so they don't bunch up and fold over on each other.
Yeah.
Sometimes that'll happen.
Yeah. So it's figuring, that's all like what those long training runs are about, right? Is kind of figuring out foot stuff.
Yeah. The answer to a lot of these questions, like what should I eat and what should I wear? The answer is almost always, it depends on what works for you. You have to find out what works for you. And people don't really like to hear that because it would be so much easier if there was just an answer for what you should eat for a 100 mile race or whatever, but it just isn't that way. The companies will tell you.
It's so simple. This is the answer. If you use this product, you will be fine. Yeah. And it's like, yep, for you, that worked.
Right.
You know, and some people are like, you know, they do salt tablets religiously. And other people are like, you know, the newest advice coming out from the studies at Western States is drink to thirst, eat, you know, eat to taste.
Yeah.
So you don't necessarily need to be taking these supplements. You just need to be eating, you know.
Yeah.
And I often, when people are nauseous, will say to them, you know, like, does anything salty sound good? No. Okay. Well, then let's, maybe you need, because hyponatremia and hypernatremia can have similar symptoms. Mm-hmm. And so it's figuring out, you know, what to, and sometimes it's just try this.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yep. You know? Yep. Mm-hmm. And you always hear stories of whatever it was at that aid station was like the magic elixir.
Yeah.
For that one person, for that one time, potentially. Yep. It might not be the same for that person the next time they do that race, but for that day, it was the chicken soup broth or whatever it was.
And then you get, you know, so then the next year, like, because I see this on the Cornell Voyager, is like, oh, you know, this was like hotcakes.
Right.
So we buy a bunch of it, and the next year, nobody takes it. And now we got all this extra stuff, but everybody wanted, you know, oranges. And the year before, nobody wanted oranges. Oh, and so I'm a big fan of watermelon with salt on it.
Yeah.
If it's a hot race, that is like something I crave. And it just, it's like a vehicle for.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So Black Hills this year, I was all over that.
Yeah.
And otherwise I don't eat at aid stations because they mostly don't have food I can eat.
Oh, right. Sure.
So
between allergies and sensitivities, I carry my own stuff.
Makes it tough.
Yeah, it makes, I like having crew for that reason. It just, then I don't have to carry.
Yeah.
Mobile buffet.
Yeah, because last year I did, when I did Black Hills, I carried pretty much everything and had drop boxes. And this year I had crew out there. I still had drop boxes because I always think, what if your crew hits a deer, gets a flat tire,
gets in an accident,
gets lost, they're not there, so. Mm-hmm.
Falls asleep.
Yeah, haven't had that happen. But, you know, but I had that as a backup, and that was really nice because then I didn't have to carry 50 miles worth of packets of food and hydration mix. And
now, kind of shifting gears a little bit, but staying with the medical side, this past year at Superior 100, there was a pretty serious incident with the bee sting and the EpiPens. And I feel like we're seeing a few more of those bee incidents than maybe we saw a handful of years ago as well. What are your thoughts on that with the EpiPens, and how much more are they potentially going to be needed in these things? And to talk maybe even a little bit about that event itself.
Yeah. So I was running this year at Superior. I was not volunteering. Mm-hmm. And this happened pretty early in the race. It was before the Split Rock aid station, so not even 10 miles in. And I'd finally gotten kind of out of, it's really crowded at the beginning of that race. And then I gotten in kind of an open area. I don't particularly like running in crowds. For those who don't know me, I'm really short. And running in a crowd means I'm at elbow height with a lot of people. Oh, and so it makes me nervous. And so I came on this just like, clog of people, and I was like, what's going on? And I get closer and I'm like, what's going on? And somebody said, oh, there's a guy, he collapsed, he got stung. And I'm like, and I just went immediately into medic mode. And I was just like, you know, let me through. And they had come upon him, he had gotten stung, gave himself epi, but passed out, which can happen, because he had a really, really strong reaction. And so they were, runners had, were trying, had, you know, activated 911, had contacted the race, but they also were trying to carry him out, thinking the best thing we can do is get him to the aid station, mm-hmm. Which was really nice of them. But this guy was 170, 180 pounds, so of dead weight.
Yeah.
And four people are trying to carry him on a single track trail.
Rocks and roots.
So I got him to put him down. I know. And he was out. This is probably the most serious medical thing I've seen outside of my training. So I got him to put him down and, asked around. And there's another runner who had an EpiPen. So he gave up his EpiPen for us. Somebody, I think he had Benadryl. Somebody else came along and had ranitidine, which is Zantac, which is we think of for GERD, for an upset stomach, but it's also a histamine blocker. It's a different, so it works differently than Benadryl. So I gave him the second Epi, and he kind of came around a little bit.
Really?
And at that point, we had him in shock position. So we had him laying flat with his legs up. Which helped a lot too, because when they were carrying him, his head was up. So now you got someone who doesn't really have any blood pressure, so blood's not getting to the brain. He was alert enough to take oral meds. We gave him the oral meds, and then he came around. Wow. And in the meantime, we're waiting for 911, those folks to show up, and we're waiting for Shalane to come. And then we're also trying to manage moving runners by. And I saw Gretchen at that point, but things were under control then. And he, by the end, he walked out. Walked out to the aid station. Wow. And, I was like, you still have to go to the ER because you can have a rebound anaphylaxis when the epinephrine wears off.
Okay.
And sorry, I had a cat trying to jump in my lap. It's just funny that of all the people in the room, the cat is jumping in my lap. So then I eventually was able to hand him off to Shalane, who was the race medic, and to the emergency crew.
Yeah.
But the lesson from that, and I told the person who gave up his EpiPen, I'm like, go to the aid station, have your crew meet you there. It'll be okay. I know it's a closed aid station, but it'll be okay because you need to have your epinephrine because there's bees out.
Yeah. Right.
And, we had that happen 2 years ago at Voyager 2 where someone got stung who didn't know he was allergic, so he didn't have epinephrine with him. Luckily, he was near an aid station, and luckily somebody at the aid station had epinephrine.
Wow. Yeah.
So we were able to kind of stabilize him until EMS arrived.
Jeez.
And Voyager's relatively easy course to get medical folks to,
most spots,
with some exceptions.
Right.
So I think, the big thing takeaway for that is if you're allergic to bees, you got to carry your epinephrine, and you can't just carry one pen. You need to carry two pens.
Yeah.
And you should really carry Benadryl and ranitidine. The epinephrine buys you time. Those other medications buy you some time to get into the hospital.
Yeah.
But then my rule of thumb is if you use epinephrine, you go to the ER. And so races that I'm lead medic on, like Kernow and Voyager, I'm like, if you see somebody using epinephrine, they are immediately pulled.
Yeah.
They don't get to argue with you. They don't get to negotiate. You're done. Because what we don't want you to do is collapse in the power lines or somewhere where we can't get to you.
Yeah.
So.
That's serious.
Yeah. Yeah. It's life-threatening.
Wow. And
this person turned out to be okay. Went into the ER. He was observed. Everything was okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I've known other people that have gone into anaphylaxis and been in the ICU for a couple days.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Live to run another day.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
And I think, it was funny because funny, not in a haha way, but when I came up to this group, I caught up to them and they're like, oh, we're waiting for you. And so I just want to say, if I'm not volunteering as medic, I don't carry stuff with me. Like I don't have a medic kit in my hydration pack.
Yeah.
So yeah. I have the knowledge in my head.
Yeah.
But
better than nothing, I guess.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I did. I have been known. I was running with someone once who had an allergic reaction and didn't have an EpiPen with, and I threw mine, because I do have an anaphylactic allergy, I threw, not to bees, into my pack just because I was like, we're going out, there could be bees, and I just can't.
Yeah, yeah.
I know you're an adult and you get to make a choice, but I'm out there with you, so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I think, and I don't know if that's part of climate change, but and these are not necessarily bees, it's ground hornets and wasps.
Right.
But a vespid is a vespid as far as your body's concerned.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
So you can develop that allergy anytime in your life.
That's scary too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know. That's what I was thinking. Like maybe runners should be carrying some Benadryl or something with them at all times, like in their packs. I mean, it's not going to take up any space or weight, so it's no big issue just to have either help themselves or help somebody else.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't ever see it becoming a requirement. That seems a little bit silly, but maybe it's just something to think about that maybe we could all do.
If you think about, like, when I do long runs, especially by myself, I have, like, a little mini first aid kit I carry with some tape and Band-Aids and whatever.
Right.
And usually I have Benadryl in there. Just because of my own allergies, I usually have Benadryl and Ranitidine and EpiPens with me. I don't carry my EpiPen when I'm running because I have to eat the thing that I'm allergic to. So I'm always like, if I don't eat it, it's not an issue. Right. But yeah, I mean, a few tablets of Benadryl and stuff in there. It takes up no space. It doesn't weigh anything.
Yeah.
Doesn't hurt.
The only thing you have to pay attention to is expiration dates on them. Yeah. I guess that's about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So...
Well, I guess what is on the docket for you,
Lisa? Yeah, what's next? That's what I'm curious about.
What's next?
Well, I have nothing planned for the rest of 2019.
Okay. Goals, thoughts for 2020?
Yeah, I'm
ruminations back
there? Yeah, I did sign up for a race already in 2020. I signed up for the Hixson 25K.
Okay.
I've been...
That's way out.
That's way out there. That's like October. Well, actually, it's November 1st of 2020 is the 25K and 50K date.
Wow.
So it's October 31st for the shorter races down there. But the lacrosse trails are fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fun running community. They put on a good race. And I've been going down now for 4 years and just have fun with that. So that's kind of my season ender.
Yeah.
That's like the frosting on the cake.
Yeah.
You know, because a 25K... I can testify you can go into a 25K fairly undertrained and do okay, because this year, my August, September, October had not been stellar training time. It's been a rough couple months. And I'm contemplating another 100-mile. I haven't decided if I'm going to sign up for it yet. It won't be Superior. So the rest of my race schedules, we're going to see how this fall, the rest of this fall goes. I've had a rough... I have a coach, and so we're kind of throwing back and forth, and I've just had kind of a rough fall. So it's going to see how I bounce back.
Just plug along through the rest of 2019 and then
Probably do the winter trail running series.
Cool.
Most of it.
Andy's races.
Yeah, I did that last year and I had a blast. This year I'm going to miss the half marathon day.
Mm.
I'll be out in Montana visiting family and just, you can only plan around races so much.
Right, yeah.
So I'm not 100% sure I'm keen on the 4-hour.
Mm.
I have kind of a shelf life for winter, being outdoors in the cold.
Yeah.
I usually say 3 hours is my max. And we'll see.
How about the New Year's run?
Oh, yes, that's on. Yes. So the barely organized New Year's Day run, walk, ski, snowshoe, bike is happening. I forget. You'll have to look this up. It might be the 11th. I posted it, but I don't remember what I posted.
Yeah, I remember seeing it.
Yeah. So that's always New Year's Day. Always New Year's Day. And at Hartley Nature Center, I get use of the building. I used to work for them before they had a building. I used to work for them. And Tom's great about letting me use the building. And so we meet at noon and we go out and we play outdoors. Doesn't matter the weather. We do not cancel for weather.
Yeah.
Suck it up. You know, we may not play outdoors as long. And then we have a potluck afterwards. And it's just a good time to get together and socialize. And having a hangover is not an excuse. The run will be good for you. You know, and I think it's just fun. It's kind of a fun gathering of folks. And it's open to anybody. My only ask is... there's limited outlets, so, I'm like, not everybody can bring a crock pot because we only have so many. I always have hot water there. I ask people to bring their own plates and utensils. I don't provide it. Barely organized, right?
Barely organized.
Yeah.
It's in the name. I know. People are like, what's the route? I'm like, whatever you want it to be. You know, there's usually groups. We all start together, but then people kind of split up into pace groups and distance groups. And then... and then just a donation to help with the cost of the building.
The building,
To building rental.
To rent
have to rent the building. So it just helps me. But this is my gift to the community. And this actually started out going back to Gene and Ed and Kathy. we always had kind of this winter running group that they had that met up in Proctor. And then I think we met for a New Year's Day run 1 year. Yeah, years ago. It must be 13 years. And it just morphed from there.
Yeah.
And, you know, we met. And back then, there, you know, we didn't use the building. We just met and ran at Hartley. And then we went to Perkins for brunch afterwards. And it's just carried on since then.
Nice.
Tradition.
Yeah. It's a tradition. Yeah. I actually have planned my travels around it. So I was like, I'll come back from Tuscobia. And then I'm going out to Montana to see my daughter. And I'm like, well, I can't come out till after January 1st. Like, you know,
I'll be there a day or two after that.
Yeah. I fly out on the 2nd. So, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Not ready to hand that one off yet. But, yeah.
Cool. All right. Any other questions, Mike?
No, I think that covers it.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Lisa.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So. Yeah. Cool. See you.
All right, and that wraps up episode number 11 of the Duluth Rundown podcast. Thank you all for joining us this week, but I guess it's, you know, every 2 or 3 weeks that we record this. But thank you for joining us. We hope you're enjoying it. We'll see you out there on the roads and the trails. Well, the roads for sure.
Adios.